Hello, everyone. Welcome to Design Together, a podcast exploring how designers work together. I am your host, Abby Ryan Guido, a designer and educator working in Philadelphia, collaborating everywhere. On today's show, we'll be talking to Chad Reichert, a professor at the College for Creative Studies and proprietor at Spirit 3 Design. Chad has a wealth of knowledge and experience to share on the topics of design collaboration, and I'm just really excited to talk to him today. Chad, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Abby. Pleasure to be here, and I look forward to getting into the weeds.
Awesome. I think it'd be great if we start, if you could tell everyone a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in the world of teaching design.
Yes. Well, I am a proud born and raised citizen of Chicago, Illinois. And so I came up through high school and college having an interest in photography. And I got exposed to graphic design early in my career when I took a graphic arts workshop using a printer and making paper booklets and with prints on it. So I had this photography, I had this darkroom experience, and I realized, and I love the computer, and I got to school, and realized that there was this thing called legitimately graphic design that kind of merged all those two together. So I attended Valparaiso University in Northwest Indiana and got an undergraduate degree in photography and graphic design. And that started it off. I started freelancing my junior year in college. I took some freelance clients after I graduated and found myself over the next couple of years working and going to graduate school. And I always knew I wanted to teach. So I filled in for my mentor at Valparaiso for a year. And that really kind of secured the bug in me. And so I pursued my studies in graduate school with the intent of making sure that I was going to teach when I got out. So I landed after a couple of trips to different schools. I landed at CCS in Detroit, and I am working on my 16th year there. And I'm currently professor of communication design, where I'm specialized in typography and communication design, and I'm lead in our motion design curriculum. Okay. So it's been a great ride so far.
How many students do you have in the program there?
Right now, we currently have about 125, if I'm correct. So we average about 25 to 35 a class. Usually that, throughout the course of the 4 years, that dwindles down a little bit, but we usually end up with an average of about 25 per graduating class.
Awesome. Well, I know you've led a lot of sponsored projects as a professor there, and I'd love for you to talk about one of these projects, and in particular, talking a little bit about how you think about team selection when you're putting together group projects, and how the teams approach the project.
So yeah, CCS is we're in a unique situation at CCS because we have this tradition of sponsored projects. So before this podcast, I went back through my CV and looked at how many sponsored projects, and I'm approaching 20 in the last 14 years, 15 years. I don't think I did one the first year. And they range from everything from automotive and Future Think, Internet of Things, to nonprofits, to branding, to even some video branding and some cross-disciplinary and interdisciplinary issues. So my approach is varied depending on the situation that I find myself in. And so when I'm selecting teams, I like to level the playing field. I don't want anyone coming into the class or into the sponsor project knowing or thinking that they might have an upper hand because they might be formally stronger. And so I usually pick students that obviously are strong work ethic, that usually almost all are very dependable in terms of time frame, in terms of deadlines, and that I usually have firsthand experience with, or one of my colleagues, they have an experience with, and that I can gauge that. So over the years, I've been able to figure out what that formula might be. So
are these sponsored projects within a curriculum of a particular course, or is this outside of coursework?
No, these are sponsored projects that act as a either an elective, or we embed them into one of our required courses.
Okay.
And they are specifically for the communication design department, and sometimes then we do a cross-discipline with either product design or automotive design or interior and so on.
So when you say that it's part of the university, I'm just curious, is it part of your department, your school, your program, or the entire university built around sponsored projects?
Yes, we have a strong culture at CCS where we have, especially in the design fields, we have an office within the CCS that manages sponsor projects. And
okay.
Corporations come, nonprofits come, and we even partner with corporations to fund nonprofit organizations. So it's kind
That's
of
awesome.
The best of both worlds. So for it could be something as simple as working for Ford or for Volkswagen, working on an interior design / experience design, to one of the last ones I did was a nonprofit for a local organization who does outreach in communities, and we were rebranding them.
Do you know the history of how that started at the school? It's very unique, and I haven't heard about anything like this before. So,
yeah, it is. We're one of the few, and it has centered around the automotive.
Okay.
Because we have the big three, and we have such a large automotive presence. Companies were coming in and looking to CCS to develop relationships, to have a pipeline for students, for employment, and also to kind of tap into the zeitgeist of the students and what they're thinking, and, you know, kind of crossing that bridge between a young, you know, audience and an older CEO or board. So it started off with automotive, and then it just expanded. And so this past year, you know, just this year alone, we've probably had between all the departments, I think it was between 10 and 15 sponsored projects throughout the college.
Wow. So the students know coming there, this is part of the curriculum and something they're going to be a part of.
Yeah. And it's a benefit that we say, you know, you come in here, and by the time you're, for us, at least communication design, when you're a junior, you are able, and if you meet the requirements and you have the right skill sets, you are able to participate in sponsored projects. But even lately, when we have our advanced branding course is our senior year, we have now been taking sponsored projects and putting it into our required course. So now the students aren't doing hypothetical projects. They're actually doing real branding with real clients. So it's a real nice advantage to have that built in. And it's not guaranteed, but we do have a pretty regular cadence of two or three sponsored projects a year just in our department.
Okay. So then when you're grouping the students up, are they typically all producing work for like the same sponsored project and kind of functioning as separate teams proposing to go in their direction? Or are they working together as a full class?
I think it depends on the size of the class. This, for example, the last big project we did was a branding for the nonprofit, and there was 25 students in the class. So we allowed them to choose teams. And I think it was seven teams of three or four that were working on the project with the same goal in mind, that they will be presenting and working towards a goal of, you know, unfortunately, and some fortune, I think we'll talk about this more,
yeah,
the competition of that one, two, or three slot and get ultimate recognition from the client. There's other sides of it where more than half the projects, I will work with a group of usually eight students on a branding project, and I select those students, and we work as a studio model, not as a competition
okay.
model. So it really depends. It really depends on what you're looking for. And we've also had larger groups of students where we've working for the same client, but I have one shared set of research that the class enjoys and contributes to. And then based on that research and those findings, one might go off into an experience space and the other one might go off into a branding space. It just really depends. But that is probably one of the better techniques that we have come across, is even on this large branding, the first 3 or 4 weeks, each group was assigned a particular aspect of research. And they shared that with a client, but they shared that with each other. And then they had access to all the research and the findings. So everyone started off on an equal basis. And mm-hmm. then from that step, they went off into their own pods and started to develop their own projects.
Do you, and I'm sure you do it differently for projects, depending on what it is, but do you help them assign what the roles are within the teams, or do you select the roles? How does that work to set up the structure within the teams?
Yeah, I think when it's a studio model, and that I'm a quote unquote the professor and the creative director, I am assigning roles, and I am actually inviting them into the class knowing that they have certain skill sets.
Okay.
So knowing that, again, I'm not looking for the ultimate form giver or giver of aesthetic. I'm looking for the writer. I'm looking for the researcher. I'm looking for the production, that
Sure.
I'm looking for.
You do a project manager.
Yeah, I'm looking for somebody who actually is a really good presenter. But the interesting thing I have found is if we have those 8 miles, about a quarter way through, we flip the model every time we have a different presentation, because we usually set it up to have 3 or 4 presentations with the client throughout the semester. Again, going back to that original idea of leveling the playing field, if students understand that the goal of this phase is to have really good research, we highlight that and we celebrate that research as a key component. And then we celebrate the prototyping, the making. Then we celebrate the actual final presentation. And so by doing that, we're kind of leveling it out and making sure that no one feels greater than each other, and it helps each other, because somebody might not be the most comfortable presenting, but when they do present, we celebrate that even more.
Sure.
Because they have to understand that this was equally important. This was a huge accomplishment just in that regard, because sometimes, as we know, the final product is like, it's okay, it's good, it's fine, the client wants it. So the successes and the celebrations have to be the little mini steps that we've taken along the way. And that usually works out pretty well.
And I think that's important too, especially to expose students to, because we both know professionally, like, they don't always pick the one you want them to. And so sometimes while it's successful and it's a good project, it's not exactly what you had envisioned. And so learning how to appreciate the process and how to learn from the process and celebrate the process is so important, because you may not feel that same way at the very end.
Yeah. And to that point is, we often celebrate language and the branding aspect of the project more than we do the final deliverables. And when and I think it's the biggest payoff and the thing that keeps the group together, because those students who might not feel like they're contributing, the majority of the visuals, but they are celebrated in the final presentation. And we had an example last time where, like, hey, this was a great project, but we have to just call out this group because they had great writing, great context, their promise and essence were spot on, and we're going to be using those. We didn't pick yours because the visuals weren't exactly where we are, but we did want to call out the fact that everything that you said in the research, you just nailed us in for that.
Yeah.
And so when we come back after the presentation is done, we all celebrate that moment more than we do the visual moment, because that's the game. It's
yeah.
The whole picture, not just one aspect of the process.
And it's also important for the students to see that, like, being a good leader is giving that feedback along the way and showing people that you appreciate their work and they did a good job, no matter what stage or where you're at. So it's great that you all are doing that. I can imagine, because I know I've experienced it, is when do we step in as instructors when there's personality conflicts in these group dynamics? I feel like it's the thing that I can't get right. Like, I see something happening, I observe it, I can feel the tension. So, sometimes I've tried, I've talked to the students separately. And usually what I get is, what are you talking about? Like, this kind of denial that there's really something going on. And then I feel crazy, like, did I just make this up? So I'm curious if you've had any of these situations and if you can share any successes so that I can learn and get a little bit better at helping guide the students.
Yeah, it's that passive aggressive thing.
Yeah.
You're looking right at it.
Yeah.
They're like, no, nothing's
wrong.
Yeah,
like, no, there's something happening.
Yeah,
I can hear it in your voices that you aren't getting along and I want to help.
Yeah, we've had a couple of instances where one of the things that we put in place over the years is that we actually have the teams evaluate each other every step. So we have a eval form that talks about what did you do? How did you do it? What was your communication? How effective were you with your follow-up? And then they had to list their individual accomplishments or the things that they...
So are they just self-evaluating or are they evaluating each other?
They're self-evaluating and they're evaluating each other.
Okay.
And then we have a quantitative and a qualitative. So we got the numbers and then we've got the date.
And do you give that feedback? Because I tested that out and I had mixed results of that too.
Yeah, we tally them up and the team gets a grade. And then once the team gets the grade, then we take their evaluations and then they get an individual grade based on how they were feedback. And it's always the first and two that are really nice. Like, oh, this team was the greatest ever, right? And then three, you're like, I don't know, Charlie didn't do a great job.
Yeah.
And then they're throwing everyone under the bus on the phase four, right? So I think, but that has helped us at least gauge it, because we have something in front of them to say, we know that there's an issue. But we also have a tendency, I team taught with my colleague this last semester, and we model the collaborative process between us. So we're both alphas and we're both professors and we're both teaching, but we have four phases of the project and we take turns and we talk to them about how, for example, my colleague did phase one and how she structured it,
okay.
How I did phase two, and then she does phase three and does phase four. But then we also talk to them about realizing like you all have individual strengths that you really need to focus on, because it's not about doing A and B. So we try to do a good job of contextualizing it as much as we can. Then we put the evaluations into place and then we start to see that passive aggressiveness. And then every once in a while, someone speaks up and says, we have an issue. And then we consult them, not as a group, but we consult them individually and try to coach them on how to resolve the issue. And most of it has to do with workload and expectation. And if they can mm-hmm. document it and include us on the documents, like, you know, this is what we're going to do, but it's not done, then it can go on our hands to say, you know what, you said you were going to do this and you didn't. And this is why you have this like dip in your, you know, unfortunately a dip into your grades. So there's a transparency that opens up, but we want to make sure that that communication is clearly established. And fortunately, the students do feel like they can come to us with problems, but they try to solve it first. And that's the key. Go to the classmate first, try to solve it, then document it, and then come to us if we need to solve it. And that seems to mitigate a lot of the issues, but it's still, some classes are perfect, they get along, and others, when you have those bigger groups, there's always those outliers that just kind of like get into the mix.
I try to encourage them early on. I've been using Slack for them to have them have a place where they all communicate, to kind of do what you do throughout celebration of a project. Is I always tell them to have a channel that's just called Cheers. And you use that just to say like, hey, Chad, thanks so much for having that done on time. Like, it really helped us out. And that if they can open the lines of communication to kind of recognize when someone's helping and they make that public, when they do reach an issue, it's not going to sound so bad if I'm starting to say, Chad, you know, you didn't meet that deadline, right? Because I've already kind of said how valuable you were to the team. And that helps a little bit, but it is hard when you see from afar something happening and you have to figure out, do I step in or not? And that's...
Yeah. I also think there's something about the buy-in of the project, because we really try to sell, and I try to not sell, but I explain to them that what you are about to embark on is very unique. And the fact that you are speaking directly with the CEO, with the CFO, right, with the store, with the board directors, there's a responsibility there. And so we naturally do see an elevation of responsibility just because these projects are real and they're large and they're expansive. And within 16 weeks, we're going from nothing to everything. And when the students start to see the impact of the project, which, you know, for nonprofit is a big deal to see the impact that your work could have on the future of that organization. When students start to understand and see, hear the stories and visit the people that they're affecting indirectly through the mm-hmm. process and building that empathy, we see a huge elevation. I think twice as much elevation in the students' responsibility from nonprofit to our corporate project. So how to frame that and where is it going and how is it going to impact? And then again, listening to the people is just, it's a huge thing. The last one we did for a nonprofit, we had zero people. People took back seats. Some stepped up, some stepped down. Others went into research and they really divided it, knowing that their work was going to be seen and heard and it was going to positively affect the community.
I feel like there's a whole research project in that, you know, you say nonprofit and then corporate. But what hit me while you were saying all of that was not having a client, fictional projects. And the ones I'm reflecting on, they happen to be fictional, even though we have people come in and who are industry experts and represent what a client would be. It's not an actual project. And I would really love to look in further about how collaborations with students work when it does switch to being something that will be produced. And does that change how the team works together and their motivation to make it work?
Yeah, I think there's two aspects to that. First, if it's the difference between it's going to be made, mm-hmm. because we also know that when we hand the files off and we hand all of this huge grand plan, that someone's going to have to execute it and we're not going to be there. So, you know, that's always this kind of, it's kind of a hope that they would achieve the level of sophistication and carefulness that we put into the project, and that never happens, or sometimes does not happen. But the flip side to that is when you're on a nonprofit, and for example, when we're working with a community-based project dealing with property tax exemptions, and this is a project that we discussed earlier on. It was about the fact that Detroit has 100% tax exemption status if you apply for it.
Okay.
Because there are many people living under the poverty line and can't afford just really, in affluent terms, it's not a lot of money for us as suburbanites, but in the inner city, when you have a community that is under the poverty level, $500, you can't afford to do that. And that basically kicks them out of their home.
Right.
So our project was awareness, and our project was about branding and bringing more people to the application process because they weren't aware that they could apply for such funds. So about, you know, it was a normal project up until about the fifth week. And we finally were able to do our ethnographic research and go into the community and visit with the stakeholders and visit with the families and ask them questions and have a face-to-face dialogue with them. And to hear the stories of the woman who had to leave her home and live in her car with two children, to have somebody else that someone came in, a landlord, came and bought the building and kicked them out with, and, but they had been living there for 20 years. You sit next to those people that are hardworking, that are genuine, that are doing the best that they can, and hear those stories and not walk away wanting to do something more persuasive and more impactful. Week five, with a little bit of that empathy, it almost was like a turbo start with the students. They're like, you know, we're in it for whatever we need to do. I will do whatever. I will step away from certain things. And everyone really kind of responded to their own strengths and weaknesses and recognized that. And that elevated that project to a whole new level because the students felt as though they were genuinely impacting people's lives, not the bottom line for a corporation. And there's nothing wrong against the corporate projects because we're all going to be working in that space.
Sure.
But there is, to your point, a completely different motivation considered. And that's the advantage of having those two types of projects.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. And it makes me start to think about, how do you create empathy if it is just a fictional project? Is it even possible to have the students have that experience without having the live clients? And it might be no. It might be a mixture of the two for, you know, successful education and successful collaboration.
Yeah, and I think too, if you're thinking about a project without a client, you can always interview the matter experts.
Subject experts.
Thank you. And you can always interview those people, but they're still only going to get you that close.
Yeah.
You can hear their stories, but unless you hear who they're talking about and what they're talking about, there is a barrier there. So, but that's at least one step getting closer to hearing the stories, at least secondhand, and maybe that can elevate it as well.
It's a dramatic shift that I've talked about actually a few times already this season. Is that when I was a design student, I remember vividly most projects, if not all, were fictional. And the idea was do everything while you can and the clients aren't ruining it, right? Like you get to do whatever you want because no one is going to tell you no, there's not a budget. And how much that shift for the positive that, you know, we are designers because we are problem solvers. And in order to solve a problem, we have to know what the problem is. And we can't have the ability to change that problem midway because we came up with a cool logo for something else.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that change is wonderful and great. And it gives the students the experience of understanding how to look for a problem and how to solve for it.
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I wanted to talk a little about spontaneity and improv in collaboration. I know this is something that you talk about, so I wanted to hear your thoughts on it.
After teaching for as long as I have or for as short as I have, you know, you fall into some patterns. And I soon realized after a couple of years, I can't plan everything out. Like I know going into the classroom, and even into certain meetings, that there's got to be about a 60% plan, 40% improv. I got to leave that space to just totally riff on wherever it needs. If the students have an idea, if something harebrained idea comes into my skull, I go off in a different direction. If I see a different process, or even if I change. And sometimes I even tell the students, I have two opportunities in this semester to change my mind, and I do not have to explain it to you. And we sometimes have that agreement, because sometimes that spontaneity is what sparks other ideas. So that 60-40 also works in the collaborative projects, because there are certain times where I have a plan in mind and we go into a meeting or go into and hear some stories, and all of a sudden, like, you just got to throw this out, and we got to shift a different direction. And as long as I think you're genuine about it and honest about how and why you're making that change in the class, students are very responsive. And I think they like the honesty and realizing, like, it's not a perfect process, so we shouldn't be treating it like that. So that scripting of, say, the first 6 weeks of class, there's a framework and a skeleton in mind. But all you have to realize that it's going to ebb and flow. And so I embrace that as much as I can and try to have as much fun in the classroom as I can based on that. So it might just be, you know, how we pick teams. We might be playing pin the tail on the donkey. We might be doing some fun games in the process. We might be halfway through a process and then we switch it up and then someone takes that research from them. We might be doing some of the exquisite corpse or surrealist games, where even in a very heavy sponsor project, it brings some levity to the situation, but it also puts us into a different space. And then it also keeps it interesting, because you, as you know, that when you're trying to hit those major deadlines and the students are starting to feel weary, you have to do something to affect that weariness to make it exciting again, or give them a break so then they can recharge on their own. So it's a frame of mind, even just the idea of, for a simple branding exercise, we do a lot of body storming where we actually improv two people in front of each other talking. One's the computer and one's the user, and the user tries to use the computer and the computer doesn't like it. A lot of those particular situations where it just brings a little bit of fresh air to it and keeps the students moving along at the clip that they need to be.
You just, you know, you're sharing this and my mind is going crazy with, oh, I could try this out. You know, I tend to be a person who has a strict deadline, and I always tell my students, like, I have a schedule and we're going to treat it like a client schedule where we're not going to change it. Like, this is what it is, because that's how it would be. And it doesn't always work. And sometimes I do have to change it. And I think personally, I can accept a little bit of this into my teaching, that, you know, things do have to change sometimes, and that's okay. And more than okay, it helps.
Yeah, it takes a while. And I think, you know, don't get me wrong, I run it like a studio. So it's a client project. And on March or February 19th, whatever it is, it has to be done because it's a client. But along the way, you know, you got your point A to Z, but, you know, B through Y can be just crazy and moving around.
Yeah.
As long as you're moving forward with your class and making the adjustments. And sometimes it is shortening up a process because you want to spend more time later in the process, because, you know, if you have a bunch of good researchers, you know, in a week and a half, you can have a pretty solid basis and maybe speed it up and say, all right, we're going to skip a week and move ahead. So that's part of the spontaneity and just listening to and hearing from the students and allowing them to provide some feedback as well and saying, you know what, I think we're good. Or, you know what, I think we have this. We don't want to talk to you anymore until we have a full draft. And so it's partnering with the students. And, you know, there's also that the catering, controlling, coaching, and consulting kind of role as a parent where you have that. And so when they're really, really young, freshman year, you are controlling them and catering to them. And so my junior and senior year, I treat the students as coaching and consulting.
Okay.
And so I don't, and just like team, like, this is what you have to do. This is how you have to execute it, but it's up to you to execute it. And sometimes that spontaneity also means you got to let them fail a little bit and hear back from the client. And the client says, you know what, I didn't really respond to this, or I didn't like that. And then you remind them afterwards, we talked about that last week. And now they understand, and they put their hand in their face and like, oh, you know, you should have listened. And, but that's, you know, you can't control everything. So again, you just got to be a little bit spontaneous and just go with the flow, knowing that they're going to make mistakes. And most of the clients, are okay with that
Yeah,
because
and
they
that's,
know that.
they need to make mistakes. It's good to have that space, because sometimes I think with client-led projects, that would be one of the pitfalls that you keep an eye on, is that, is there room for mistakes? Is it too high, pressure that they can't have that? So it's nice that there's still that space to have that. You had started this, kind of mentioned this, but it's something that I love talking about, and that is competition. I same with looking back on curriculum being about, doing whatever you want while you're in art school, and then having, the real world hit you, is competition, is that I think that when we both entered this field, it was spoken about as this cutthroat, you are giving your life to something where you're not going to make money, you're never going to be famous, but you're going to be super competitive with all these people that no one else outside of design is going to care about. And has that changed, and should it change, and how does it play into, student collaboration when they're competing against one another?
Yeah, I think that's it's a really,
And we could
really,
talk for
yeah,
hours
it's a
about
really good
competition.
question. But our department, just our specifically our department, is very collegial, and all the students are, and it's one of the strengths of our student body in the communication design department because they are really looking after. We have a mentor program, seniors and juniors mentor freshman and sophomore. They're a close-knit group, and we don't have a lot of competition. That being said, when the sponsor projects come through and we have to go to a larger group and we have to divide up the teams, as I mentioned before, one of the things that we work to ease that is that shared research model. Everyone starts off the same basis. And it's interesting because the last project we did, everyone has shared research. Most people, some people obviously were still learning, so had some hiccups along the way. The team that was deemed the worst research by the client and said it wound up winning the project. So it's that idea too, is like, I think it's a grounding force. Like everyone sees each other's research, everyone works so everyone else can get that same kind of level of understanding. And then they work on that project. And we didn't let them see any deliverables until the final. It's the first time I had ever done that. And we did have some kickback from some students, like, this department, we are friends, we are colleagues, just adamant. Why does this thing have to be a competition? And that's just the practicality of it because it's a large number, and it's, this is what the real world is going to be. If you're not, five or six of you in your studio, your studio is going to be competing against five or six other studios. So it's just a natural thing they have to do. So I think it's a great learning curve for them to do. I personally love to work in a studio model, and even if I have to divide the teams up into certain categories, I love doing that. The team competition is fine. It's a necessity. But in the end, everyone was clapping and rooting for each other. And we know that there are other departments in our school that are super competitive, as you're talking about. And I think the students just pride themselves on, like, you know what? It's okay. We're going to get past this, and it's a learning. And every once in a while, we'll hear some complaints, but.
It's good though that you said they already have that in, and I think the mentorship program, I'm sure, helps kind of promote that connection with the students. Is there anything else that you all have done to help encourage this community? Because I do think that's what it comes down to, and for me, that's what I've seen. It seemed like kind of natural that the students have gotten much more supportive of one another. I think that people in general just have more empathy these days, and we're seeing that in our students. But is there any other tips you can give to anyone about how to create a space for a design community to grow?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of natural, like, advantages, environmental advantages we have because our entire we're on the eighth floor of a in our facility, and it's a completely open facility. There's no walls, so you can walk by everyone else's students to see exactly what they're working on, see what they're critiquing. We have these large walls that are permanent display, like in our studio, that we hang up all the student projects, so they see their colleagues working on project that they worked on last year. So I think environmentally, we just have a really interesting model. I think the faculty try to model it as much as possible as well. Our program is a combination of interaction, motion, print, and typography all in one. So our foundation is actually web design, motion, and type courses. And then we build it up from there. So when you get into the upper classes, you have to rely on your classmates because one might be doing some coding or using a Raspberry Pi, but they're not very good at it. And they will go to the person in the other class or someone else and say, can you help me out? And that's how we teach the classes. But the faculty also model that, because when there's something that I'm not an expert in, I will turn to my colleague and bring them in. So I think it's in addition to not having physical boundaries, we're encouraging those intellectual boundaries to be broken down, because we can't do it without each other. And in the end, and especially when it comes to the senior year, we have seniors reaching out to alum that are a year out who had done a processing thesis and asking them to say, can you give me some advice? So even our alum are actually tapping back into our and feeding that community. And I think that that's something that we pride ourselves on, but it's taken time and building up the messaging, meetings, mentoring. We have a lot of food. Our student meetings are all food.
Well, I wanted to talk about food because I know that food plays an important role in collaboration, and I want to hear your take on all that.
So anyway, so that's the crux of it. There's a lot of different things, but yes, food. I love eating food, but I love breaking bread with others. And I think that that's really helped. And so to build that community as well, there's oftentimes where I just build in non-class-based field trips. And we just go out into the city of Detroit and we go get donuts. We go to Sister Pie. We go to all these bigger bakeries and we sit down and we just have food together. And I find that when the students are outside of the classroom and they carpool together, they see what each other's wearing. They actually get dressed up rather than sweatpants and a hoodie coming in. What they eat, how they talk about, all of a sudden breaks down those boundaries. So it's not just my classmate, but these are normal people as well. So food plays a huge role in that. So all sponsor projects have a food line budget is, and every presentation we sit down and eat. And that has a lot to do with a community. And sometimes the students, it's probably the biggest meal that they've had all week. Some, you know, kids are not eating what they should, or they don't have the money. So they're skimping on that. So we want to make sure that they're well nourished, and that's a point of pride and a point of community. And so I take my catering responsibilities just as strong as I take my teaching responsibilities, because when they learn to expect that, it's a performance and it's an uplift. And then thesis class, senior, will break bread and have potluck together. And so it's a big part of my life, but it's also something that I want to share with the students. And we've reaped the rewards. We'll put pictures up of, like, you know, the kids eating on Instagram, and some other kids like, well, why aren't we eating? And I go, all right, well, let's eat. And then or if it's Halloween, we have a huge Halloween potluck where all the students contribute food, faculty contributes food, and brings us together for fun for, you know, 45 minutes, 50. Big part, but in terms of your collaboration and teamwork as well, when they know we're all in this together and we're all trying to support and look for each other, some of those competitive boundaries do come down and say, you know what, we're just trying to work hard, and it's okay if we have to compete for a couple times a semester.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where we landed as well. We had these conversations, is that, like, one-off projects where you're competing is, you know, as positive thing and can help kind of raise the bar a little bit. And it, you know, sometimes can replace, if it's not a sponsored project, it can replace a little bit of that, like, drive to do well. But some of the competition, when it comes down to who has the top portfolio, who's overall the best, it can be very hard to create a positive culture and still have those instilled. And I know that that's a long history in a lot of design programs.
Yeah. And I think too, because we're talking about, if we have 25 kids in the program, we'll have six people doing experience. We'll have one doing all type. We'll do four doing motion, and then some other print or some navigation stuff. And so when you do something like that, and then it's hard to compare and realize that everyone's doing their own thing. So that individuality kind of helps realize, like, everyone's doing their own thing. And by the senior year, everyone's tired. Yeah. Everyone really just wants to, like, help each other so they can get out.
Sure. And I think that those changes in design, you know, I think that it's not so much a jack of all trades anymore. And it's kind of impossible to know everything. And I think that that has helped kind of change design and the competition approach a little bit as well.
Yeah, agreed.
So I know that your professional practice is also built around collaboration. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like and what type of work you're doing?
Yeah, so Spirit 3 founded about 96, 1996, 1997, and it started off as mostly branding. And throughout the years, it's emerged into branding consulting, helping people establish businesses with a technological and social infrastructure, obviously facilitating that branding, but it's motion, it's interactive. It's print, it's a combination of everything. From about 15 years ago, I made a major shift and actually started including my students that I have in school. So I pay them good wages. They are interns. And on a specific project, if I need to have illustration help, if I need to have coding help, if I just need to have some video work done and to shoot them, I want to give them experience. And it's the same model that I use for the sponsored projects. I know these students, I know their work ethic, I know that they respond to email, they can talk and they'll have a dialogue with you and they're professional. So I've probably employed 12 to 15 students over the last 15 years. And then a lot of those relations have blossomed into when they graduate and alum. Now I have alum who have their own offices, who intern for me, and now we collaborate and then they can do some bigger stuff. So I think it's that idea, like my Spirit 3 practice, the more I do, the more I model in the classroom. And I really enjoy that. And I've even gone as far as one of my clients who's they're ongoing, and it's about the 6th year we've had a relationship. I set up an intern program for them, feeding in CCS students. So they're at intern number 5 now, where we walk them through the process. I'm their boss. The client pays the bills. And we do a 3 month and a 6 month evaluation. We expose them hands on. They come in like, this is what you're going to need to do. I know what they can do. So they do it very well. And then as they progress over the 6 months and the 9 months, they get more responsibility. And then at the end of the 12 months, they either move on happily having this experience. And we've hired somebody we had for 2 years, and we promoted her from intern to designer. And she took over the day-to-day, and I managed the big picture. And I love that. And so that's how that feeds the school model as well. And the students love it. They enjoy it. They get, and again, I don't take advantage of they get
Sure.
paid very well. And they know that they're going to get time off at Thanksgiving and Christmas. And the clients know that, like, come December, don't call them. So we plan the schedule around their deadlines and stuff like that. And it's a model that works, but it helps me extend my model, because I can't do everything and I don't have the time, because I do teach 3 classes a semester. I don't, it's not, it's a 3-3. So for me to, in order to maintain my studio practice throughout the year and then build it up in the summer and then be able to sustain it throughout the school year, I need to have people in the bunker with me that can take on those small responsibilities and make sure that things are ticking along.
Sure. I saw a project on your site I wanted to talk to you about. It's a collaborative project, the Mrs. Burns Dictionary of Unusual, Obscure, and Preposterous Words and Letters. And it's beautiful and well documented, and I wanted to hear a little bit about how that took place.
Yeah, so my colleagues, Sue Laporte and I, a couple of years ago, we've always wanted to do collaboration. And we have a chance, we do chance methods in our senior year. So they've been through 3 years of this rigid process. And, and like at the senior year, they do your thesis. So we introduce them to how chance could affect their outcomes. So we kind of give them a bunch of parameters and they start testing it out and they do some kind of crazy Brian Eno card kind of strategies, oblique strategies. So we want to do it. We both have a keen interest in type design, typography. So I believe we had a faculty show coming up, and I just put out a text and I said, "Who's in? Who wants to collaborate?" Sue responded, "I'm in." So we set up some basic guidelines. We didn't even have the subject matter. We knew we were going to do a type design project, and we decided that we want to do the alphabet. So it became a 26-day project. We went to John King Bookstore, which is like the most amazing used bookstore in Detroit, 4 stories, and we went to find an obscure dictionary or
Okay.
some kind of reference point. And we got up to the reference section. 2 identical books right next to each other was the Mrs. Burns dictionary. And so we opened it up. They were identical. They were signed old school, and it was all these obscure words. So we put a system down. I took the odds and she took the evens. So she had A, C, E, and so on. And then I had B, D, and we assigned numbers, codes, and we had 1 day. you had to finish a letter.
Okay.
And so in 26 days we were done, and we didn't collaborate with each other, but we showed each other our progress. And then it was amazing how some of the typefaces started to look like each other or shared qualities. And so it was all black and white experience. It was all risograph. And then that turned into a bigger collaboration where we started to make our own words.
Ah, fun.
So we would take two alphabets or two words or two letters, mash them together, and then we'd also mash up the words to create new definitions. So then we started making prints, and we started doing scarves, and we did all these fun things to do. And it was, again, it was that motto of like, and we demonstrated this to the students, like, you guys sometimes are a little hesitant to take some risks. We would walk them through the process that, we didn't know what we were doing until we got into the bookstore, and look what happened. It just turned itself into something that was fun. And we still have plans to do more, but then the pandemic hit, our access to our Rizzo got cut off, and then all of a sudden, Mrs. Burns done.
It's fun to have those projects and to show students too that, like, you know, you don't have to always have in mind what's going to happen. Like, and also, I think for faculty listening, you know, often we get this pressure that, you know, you should be interdisciplinary, you should collaborate and work together. And we know that those forced collaborations never really turn out. And it is more of those organic, like, let's take a trip to the bookstore and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so it
was a lot of fun. And I remember that one of my favorite moments was I had Indian ink in a straw, and I was trying to make the letter, I forgot what the letter, T. And I was just blowing Indian ink in patterns for like an hour. And I'm like, this is silly. And then it turned out to be one of my favorite letters, digitized and stuff like that. So I think it's again, that spontaneity and the improv of design that makes it really fun and kind of gets you excited and puts you in a different space that you're not necessarily would go in otherwise. And the fact that Sue and I work together and pushing and pulling off each other, and she's like, what about this? And they're like, well, let's do this. And it was just the kind of this giant, like, you know, riff on each other that turned into something fun. And we hope that students were able to take away from that, because we, in the faculty show, it finally got hung up and we had a description there, and we intentionally, not to self-promote, we took them down there and said, okay, we did this.
Yeah.
This is how we did it. And you can do this too. And it was a type class. And of course, and you know, some people got it, some people didn't, but at least we tried, right?
Yeah. I think it's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate great work. That.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chad, for being here today. And if you want to learn more about Chad, you can check out his website. It's spirit3design.com. Thanks so much. Thank you all so much for listening. If you are enjoying our show, please post us a review on whatever podcast streaming platform you use. To learn more about us, check out our website at designtogetherpod.com.